Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, media tell us this week marks the fifth anniversary of the financial crisis, since it was September 2008 that global financial services firm Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy. Meanwhile, 6 in 10 people tell pollsters they don't think the country could avoid another collapse, which the Washington Post write-up called a pessimistic outlook. But are people pessimistic or realistic? We'll hear from financial blogger Mike Konzel of the Roosevelt Institute about that. Also on Counterspin today, a new study of the controversial gas drilling tactic known as fracking seems to be good news for the industry. Maybe no surprise, since they funded it. But are the findings about methane leaks as good as the press reports make them sound? We'll put that question to Hugh McMillan of the group Food and Water Watch. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The House Republican plan to cut $40 billion from the SNAP food stamp program over the next 10 years has been getting a lot of media attention, but sometimes reporters let balance get in the way of the facts. In USA Today on September 18th, readers were told that the costs of the program have exploded. Why? Well, here's the paper's explanation. Quote, "Democrats say the program has grown because the economy tanked. Republicans argue much of the expansion is attributed to states giving benefits to people who do not qualify." Close quote. Well, we know there was a massive economic collapse and a painfully inadequate recovery, so that's reality. But Republicans say the program is full of fraud. Is that true? No one could know from this USA Today account. A politician who agrees with the cuts says so, and one who opposes them says that's a lie. Who's right? Well, we know that there's evidence that, according to the Inspector General of the Agriculture Department, there's basically no serious overpayment fraud. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities reports that SNAP, quote, has one of the most rigorous payment error measurement systems of any public benefit program, close quote. The group also points out that historically, and rather predictably, food stamp programs swell in times of economic distress. So why can't USA Today report these facts? Perhaps because it would seem like they would be taking a side. They'd prefer to take no position. That's why the subhead of the piece says that these cuts could cut waste or hurt poor, depending on viewpoint. That's perfectly balanced journalism and horribly misleading.
After NPR CEO Gary Nell stepped down abruptly, the public radio giant named a new acting boss, who happens to be a major Republican donor with ties to two prominent conservative think tanks. Paul Haga was already a member of the NPR board. His career path included some time spent as chair of the Investment Company Institute, which is the lobbying arm of the mutual fund industry. And he's affiliated with the American Enterprise Institute and Hoover Institution. Haga made a $32,000 donation to the Republican National Committee this year. In recent years, he's donated to Republican politicians like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. Now, according to right-wing mythology, NPR is a decidedly left-wing media outlet, living off government subsidies whilst pushing its liberal agenda. You can tell that's not true if you listen to the network, or if you consider the sort of folks they choose to put in charge.
CNN brought back the old left-right debate show Crossfire a few weeks ago. But there's one big question. Is Stephanie Cutter, one of the left hosts, there to represent the left or the White House? Cutter has a day job heading up a PR firm called Precision Strategies, meaning that she has other clients that CNN viewers don't know about. And early this month, a Fox News report said Cutter was part of a White House strategy session on selling the Obama administration's Syria policy. So that could mean Cutter takes part in meetings to craft the White House message and then goes on TV to talk about that White House message. Turns out it's not just about Syria. She was also, according to the New York Times, brought in to talk up Larry Summers to the media before he bowed out of the race to become the next chair of the Federal Reserve. Now, Cutter doesn't deny any of this. As she told Politico, "No one's ever accused me of not saying exactly what I think." Well, that isn't the point. If Cutter is huddling with the White House and then going on TV to grade the White House's performance, that's a problem. Maybe not for her, but it should be for the news outlet that employs her, which is supposed to care about these conflicts of interest.
We mentioned last week that some lawmakers are on a listening tour, getting an earful from corporate CEOs about how they pay too much in taxes. You could read a September 16th USA Today story as part of that PR campaign. Headlined, "Biggest Beneficiary of Tax Breaks? You." The piece tells readers that the country's $1.2 trillion in tax expenditures are, quote, not all corporate tax giveaways and special interest handouts. More than 90% of federal tax breaks go to individual taxpayers, close quote. Well, the story explains, quote, non-taxable Social Security benefits will save retired and disabled people $32.9 billion, up 59% since 2009. Employees will save $212.8 billion because their employer-provided health benefits aren't taxed, a 47% increase from 2009, close quote. But wait a minute. Social Security is a program that puts some of your income, which you've already paid taxes on, into a fund that you can draw on if you live to retirement. It's unclear how allowing this return of some of your own money qualifies as a giveaway. And the fact that your boss doesn't pay taxes on the cost of your health care premiums, which has increased dramatically in recent years, probably doesn't feel like much of a perk. It's worth noting that in most industrialized countries, health insurance is considered a government obligation to the population in general, not a special benefit to particular individuals. The piece does include a comment from someone from Citizens for Tax Justice who suggests the focus is on the wrong tax breaks. Quote, if you have a spending program and 68% of that money goes to the richest 1%, most people would think that's pretty bad, close quote. That's actually a major point of the research USA Today is reporting. Yes, tax expenditures are broadly felt, but the benefits tend to disproportionately flow upwards. The study underscored that, quote, 10 major tax breaks that together total more than $750 billion in tax savings in 2013 are tilted heavily in favor of the top income earners. 17% of the benefits from these major tax breaks go to the top 1% of households, close quote. That's a very different message than saying little guys are gobbling up more of the goodies than corporations.
And finally, the Census Bureau announced that median household income fell for the fifth straight year to its lowest inflation-adjusted level since 1995, as many Americans continue to suffer from home foreclosures and crushing debts. Incomes for top earners, however, have continued to soar, making for a country of record-high inequality. The Wall Street Journal seems to be on the story, after a fashion. The Murdoch-owned paper recently announced a job opening for a reporter for their mansions section. The successful candidate, the Journal says, will break news and write ambitious stories on, well, mansions. If you think that's a window on a very small world, think again. The Journal says mansions features touch on, quote, a wide range of topics. Past covers have included a profile of a billionaire from Kentucky who owns more than 1 million acres of land, an analysis of the market for the homes of college football coaches, and an exclusive look at Larry Ellison's plans for the island of Lanai, close quote. Ellison is the fifth richest man in the world. Now, some might call it gross materialism, but News Corp CEO Robert Thompson suggests a Democratic take, since, quote, we all like to think of our home as a mansion, even if it is a humble abode, close quote. Oddly, humble abode was apparently rejected as the section's title.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Barack Obama hosted an event September 16th, marking what ABC, along with numerous outlets, called the five-year anniversary of the financial crisis. 5 years ago this week, Christiane Amanpour told CNN viewers, the collapse of Lehman Brothers kicked off the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. It was a terrifying moment when no one knew if the whole global economy would implode. While the focus of most such reports was Obama's contention that we have cleared away the rubble from the financial crisis and begun to lay a new foundation for economic growth and prosperity. Though, to Amanpour's credit, she followed up with an interview with former FDIC chair Sheila Bair, who indicated there was still a fair amount of rubble left to clear. Our next guest says the tendency to frame the financial crisis as something that started in September 2008 is misleading, and misleading in a way that could impact what we do going forward. Mike Konzel is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He blogs at Next New Deal. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Mike Konzel.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, obviously it's a kind of shorthand, but what is so troubling about marking the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy as the start of the crisis, this one terrifying moment? And what more broadly do you think is being missed or misunderstood in the prevailing conversation about the crisis?
Absolutely. The failure of Lehman Brothers and the subsequent failure of AIG was very traumatic for the economy. You can see in all kinds of different indicators, it was a very traumatic time for just the financial industry as a whole as well. But if you look back at the crisis, it actually starts earlier in 2007. This is actually not that controversial among financial economists. The panic that actually started to generate the problems between banks lending and in the capital markets were basically derived from the fact that subprime mortgages were starting to default in massive numbers. It made people very nervous about the mortgage-backed securities that were going on at that time. So when we look at 2008, we look at Lehman Brothers, we look at AIG, there are ways we can combat those problems. We can make banks hold more capital. We can have special legal regimes that fight too big to fail. We can do things to derivatives to make them better collateralized, make them less likely to have these AIG structures where they take huge bets, and if they don't pay out, they just disappear. But that won't actually deal with housing, and it won't actually deal with the bad faith that Wall Street, I think, generated among a lot of people when it came to both how it sold mortgages, how it packaged them, how it deceived investors, how it really laid waste to a lot of neighborhoods, and then separately, post-bailouts, how Wall Street has behaved since then.
Well, I'd like to get your reaction to a recent piece on the Washington Post blog that asked a question on many minds. Of the rogues gallery who led the major Wall Street firms to the brink of the abyss, only to have a multi-trillion dollar taxpayer bailout pull them back, why have none become familiar with our nation's federal prison system? But blogger Neil Irwin kind of winds up suggesting that though the impact of their actions was devastating, criminal prosecutions of the leaders of the big banks just weren't legally achievable and are kind of beside the point. Setting aside for a second whether system-wide reform is ultimately more important, didn't the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission find that not just bad practices, but there was actual fraud in the behavior of some of these lenders?
You know, the legal issues are beyond my pay scale. It's very difficult to get criminal charges on a transaction where both people agree to it. So, you know, it's just hard to bring the criminal law into it. There are things that they could have done, and it's clear that they didn't push as far as they wanted to. I think they're also, a lot of the regulators, Department of Justice as well, is very risk averse. They don't want to lose a case, so they don't bring up cases unless they think they're very strong. I think why people are concerned about criminal justice, it's that there's a real cultural norm problem. We see it on the front end with a lot of mortgages. There's been numerous stories, and the FCIC documents them as well, of Wall Street making mortgages that they expect to fail. And that's really bad for our investments. I mean, we want our economy, we want our financial economy to be making investments that they think are good ideas and certainly not something that they want to see sabotaged. Separately, since the crisis, and especially true in 2011, 2012, there's the mirror image of the abuses that went on making mortgages. There's been abuses in the foreclosure process where people who don't even have a mortgage are being foreclosed on. There's a really big record of shoddy record keeping. And there's settlements and they're broken. And I think that goes to a cultural issue and a set of norms issues that's very difficult to regulate.
Well, Morgan Stanley Chief Executive James Gorman told Charlie Rose recently, talking about the crisis, quote, "The probability of it happening again in our lifetime is as close to zero as I could imagine," close quote. And that reminds me of the precision with which executives at Exxon could guarantee that they would never have an oil spill the size of the Valdez. Gorman's imagination aside, what has actually happened that could help prevent a recurrence, and what still needs to happen?
Yeah, that's what I meant by the perniciousness of thinking in terms of Lehman's, because there are things we have done that have made 2008 less likely. I don't know if they're zero likely, but even if they were, that doesn't mean that there's suddenly not a problem with the financial sector. We see it in our foreclosed neighborhoods, and we see it with a sense of, you know, the economy is just not working for everyday Americans. There's a lot of things that went wrong in 2008, but the two things that stand out in the imagination are Lehman Brothers and AIG. And for Lehman Brothers, the FDIC now has legal authority to take over the firm, put losses on, and then spin it back out. To put it a different way, the way people understand what went wrong with Lehman was like a bank run, like in It's a Wonderful Life before FDIC. So we conceptually understand the idea of how to resolve that problem. We have something actually called resolution authority. There's a lot of debate about how well it works, but there is a general consensus that it's coming in well. The other thing is AIG essentially took huge positions in derivatives. It basically made a giant bet on the housing market using these instruments called derivatives. And then if it worked, they made a lot of money. And if it didn't work, well, you know, they didn't have to pay it out because there was no money to pay it out. There's a lot of reforms in the derivatives market designed to force collateral, force price transparency, to ensure that no one character can kind of cause these problems. I don't want to overstate it by any means. I think there's still a lot of problems. But there is progress made, and crucially, I think we can understand what an end game looks like for some of those problems, where for other things, like the whole issue of legitimacy on Wall Street, I think it's much harder to understand that path.
Well, the new census numbers, as I'm sure you know, show median household income fell for the fifth straight year, while income for top earners keeps rising. So on this question of inequality, I wonder if you could address, if not the specifics, but sort of the general idea of Tom Edsel's recent piece in the New York Times. He's not alone, certainly, in suggesting that while the dramatic increase in inequality is lamentable, it's a market issue, so you shouldn't really expect government to do much about it. How do you react to that idea?
Well, I mean, it's often tough to distinguish between government and markets in a lot of these spaces, especially if you go into the tippy top of inequality. It's a lot of financial income. There are doctors in the 1%, but they tend to peter out. And then when you get in the top half of 1%, that's when there's the really large incomes, and that's really a narrow kind of financialized set of incomes. There are just down the line things from like patent law to copyright to how strong the economy is that influences the distribution in very profound ways. But when you look at the way the financial industry has evolved, you have to question whether or not these incomes really reflect contribution to the economy, smart investments, creating value that works for everyone, or if there's something else entirely divorced from the actual value it created, because the major investment Wall Street took on in the last 10 years was these huge investments in housing that turned out to be absolutely worthless.
You can read that the median household income is falling, and then you turn a page and read that the economy is in recovery. I think the word disconnect is probably overused, and not least by me. But can we at least say that reporting about the economy in broad strokes is inadequate if we want journalists to be saying something meaningful and understandable about life as it's lived by most people?
If things were working out well, I think there would be a lot less concern about inequality, and there may even be less concern about things like the financial sector. I think it's when people are particularly struggling and the economy as a whole is doing poorly to see, you know, huge gains at the top 1%. Last year, the top 1% took home the second highest record of the share of income since, you know, the only year that beat it was 1928. So, you know, this inequality trend is growing. My question is, how much has finance had to do with that? And I think there are reasons to believe that that is relevant. And there are ways that the law encourages that through the tax code, through the way that firms are structured, that could be pushed against by Congress if it was interested.
And what about, finally, the perspective of reporters? Are there different approaches you might like to see them take in order to make things more transparent for folks? Or what would you like to see more or less of in economic coverage?
The way that the financial crisis is still with us and the devastation and foreclosures, that whole process, there's obviously been a very big push to think that housing has largely recovered and is doing better, but that is not entirely the case. There are still neighborhoods that are really struggling, and that is sincerely holding back the economy. I think one of the big questions that's tangentially related but still very relevant is whether or not the economy will get better on its own, or whether or not we will actually need serious reform of the financial industry and the housing market, a serious stimulus effort, something by the Fed, to genuinely restart it. Because it's been 5 years since the recession started. That's half a decade. And we can get comfortable with mediocre growth, but there really needs to be a recovery to what we potentially can make.
We've been speaking with Mike Konzel, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. You can find his work online at nextnewdeal.net. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
New scientific paper published in Scholarly Journal doesn't exactly scream breaking news. But when the topic is hydraulic fracturing or fracking, and the research seems to show that one of the main environmental problems associated with gas drilling isn't as bad as we've been told, well, that paper is bound to make some news. New research from the University of Texas is giving credence to the idea that drilling for natural gas can be just as environmentally friendly as those natural gas commercials you're seeing on TV or you're hearing on the radio. But what are the question marks about this particular study? Joining us now to take a closer look at what the report says and what it doesn't say is Hugh McMillan of the group Food and Water Watch. Hugh McMillan, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as I understand it, the controversy over all of this goes like this. Compared to coal or oil, natural gas produces far less carbon dioxide. That makes it attractive. The issue is the release of methane gas in the process of doing this fracking. Methane is a much more intense greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So we've had research showing that there are serious problems with methane leaks associated with fracking. Now, along comes this new study financed almost entirely by the industry saying, hey, that problem is not as bad as you've been told. We should, of course, doubt any industry-backed study, and most of the news accounts I've seen point out this funding, but before we get to the results, what are some of the other red flags here in terms of the design, if you will, of this research?
One of the primary ones is the sample size used. Some media outlets are reporting that the study sampled 190 well sites, including 489 wells, but in fact it only sampled 27 so-called flowback completions, which is the process where the well is cleared immediately after drilling and fracking, when these fluids, a mix of the liquid and gas and sand, flows back up and under high pressure, it needs to be contained to avoid some methane emissions. So only 27 actual wells looking at emissions directly in the aftermath of fracking operations. And we know that that's a very small sample size. We know there are outliers and so-called super emitters that can make up a very large portion of overall emissions. Another important caveat is that the large majority of these 27 flowback completions had implemented so-called green completions or reduced emission completions, which is, you know, an ideal. So certainly some technology can be used to greatly minimize emissions during this stage, but the reality is that they are not widely used, and industry will fight at every step to make sure that these mitigation efforts are not enacted and enforced.
I read one account say that this was kind of a study of the ultimate best practices if the industry adopted all of them, and at wells that big players in the industry chose to be part of the study. Is that about
right?
That's right.
And for this particular link in the entire chain of the natural gas supply chain. And it also has nothing to do with methane emitted when fracking for oil.
Now, the findings were portrayed in a lot of the press coverage as mostly, if not entirely, good news for the industry. That's the outcome they'd hope for, but you wrote that there was still some bad news here for the corporations that paid for the research, or at least the findings weren't as ultimately exonerating as maybe they would have liked.
There was. So there were 190 well sites, 27 of the 190 data points were for these flowback completions, and the remaining 163, those were looking at well sites where the wells were producing gas and had been for some time. So it was long after the actual drilling and fracking operations. And it turned out that those were leaking methane at a much higher rate than EPA currently estimates in its annual greenhouse gas inventory.
So, you know, one of the accounts that I saw was comparing those EPA numbers with this study, and it said something like 5.1 billion pounds a year versus 5.6 billion. That was the EPA number. And to a non-scientist, it doesn't sound like a huge difference in what the EPA was kind of projecting for fracking.
It is clear that methane is a big problem. You know, natural gas, which is primarily methane, burns more cleanly than oil and burns more cleanly than coal, but it still is a fossil fuel. It's still burning. It still emits a significant amount of CO2, and climate scientists are clear that time has run out on using natural gas as a bridge fuel. It may have been a viable bridge fuel 20 years ago, but the situation with the emissions of greenhouse gases is such that we need to get off all of fossil fuels as soon as possible.
Now, we might want to point out finally that it's not just methane, that critics of fracking are saying the problem with this is much more than how much methane is emitted during the production cycle.
That's right. It's not just the production cycle. It's the entire natural gas system. So production, processing, transportation, and distribution, there are leaks all along the way that are not well quantified at all. And it would take many years to completely understand and quantify these leaks. And in the meantime, we are just pumping more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Hugh McMillan is a senior researcher in the water program at the group Food and Water Watch. You can read his piece about this new study on fracking at foodandwaterwatch.org. Hugh McMillan, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can find more information on FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.